From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. Is there a profession of authorship in America? What are its commercial and cultural characteristics? The center recently sponsored a discussion of those and related questions. Soundings now presents part three of the profession of authorship in America, with particular attention to changes since the turn of the 20th century in the work of professional writers, editors, publishers, reviewers, and literary agents. The speakers are James West, Matthew Hodson, Lee Smith, Edmund Fuller, and Kent Mulliken. James West is a scholar at the National Humanities Center and a professor of English at Virginia Polytechnic Institute. At the center, he's writing a book about authorship in America. Matthew Hodson is director of the University of North Carolina Press. Lee Smith has written novels and short stories. Her most recent books are Black Mountain Breakdown and Cakewalk. She teaches creative writing at North Carolina State University. Edmund Fuller is chief book critic for the Wall Street Journal. He's written novels, nonfiction, and textbooks. And Kent Mulliken is my colleague at the National Humanities Center. Here is James West.
Literary agents are a fairly recent arrival on the American book scene. That is to say, there were no true professional literary agents in America before 1893, when Paul Revere Reynolds became an agent in New York. Before that time, there were informal agents in this country, and back on into the 1870s and 1880s, there were literary agents in Britain. But it's a relatively new profession in that sense, and the responsibilities of the agent have changed quite a bit since Reynolds' time. Initially, literary agents dealt primarily with transatlantic problems. That is to say, they were agents for British publishers and authors on the American book scene, and then vice versa, tried to interest British publishers in some of what was being published in America. They dealt with contractual problems there. They dealt with the importation of plates or sheets, things of that sort. After the turn of the century, they increasingly became involved with magazine work, and in the great boom, the heyday of magazines and freelance writers and fiction writers too, the days of the old Saturday Evening Post and Liberty and Collier's and all of those big slicks, the agents often made the bulk of their income by serving as middlemen between the writers and the magazines. They still do that to some degree, but it's my understanding that today the great majority of their time is taken up with what we know as subsidiary rights. That is to say, all of the ways that an author can recycle a work of literature after the initial act of composition. And there are a great many more possible ways of recycling a work now than there used to be. We think of movie rights and drama rights and radio and TV rights right off the bat, but you also have book clubs, you have paperbacks, you have foreign translation rights, you even have cassette rights, all sorts of spin-offs from a popular work of literature. And the agent can be immensely important to the writer in that way. Can also do things like help him with his tax situation and his tax returns. And many agents, again, it's my understanding, are beginning to function more and more as editors used to function. Mm-hmm. They actually do acquire manuscripts and edit them and commission them and serve as middlemen in that sense.
To the best of my knowledge, and I would defer to anything, you know, correction Jim might make, that this has always been done by book publishers.
Yes.
A certain amount of commissioning books.
Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot more of it, though, now.
Well, I think
with the commercial
houses. I think the problem with editors is that the editors who loomed large, let's say, in the teens of the 20s, and go back to Richard Watson Gilder, who did everything, feel that their status within the company is just no longer what it was. That's the problem. You always need people who are going to help an author or refine his or her manuscript and so forth. But such people no longer occupy the positions of esteem within the firm that they once did. And this is a dispiriting sort of a situation. Basically, the marketing people in publishing are in control, as they are in American industry generally. I think the automobile industry is a very good example.
Well, I remember...
The engineers lost control and the marketing people took over.
I remember my first job as an editor was with Crown Publishers, and I was their first editor when they began to publish after having been just an outlet distributing firm. Well, they may be one of the wealthiest publishing firms in the business now, and they're very good at the kind of things they do, but I remember as a very, very young, hopeful and idealistic editor being crushed when Nat Wortels once said bluntly that the heart of a publishing house is its salesman. And I didn't, and I don't still entirely agree with him, but I now understand what Nat meant. And I now understand the sense in which that is true from the business side of things, but what I think Nat probably never ever will quite realized by his own temperament is the contribution that an editor makes to that process.
Well, I think
sales oriented and
Crown Publishers is very much a business.
Very much a business. Yet they've published some very good, solid backlist books. He's a backlist fanatic, and also a great deal of Judith Krantz style schlock.
I think another thing that we really haven't mentioned is that the degree to which publishing in this country is concentrated in the Northeast and specifically in New York. And if you're a writer who does not happen to live in New York or have close contacts there, you have to have an agent. You just simply have to have it, because a lot of things are just decided through personal contact, you know, repeated personal contact, several lunches and this sort of thing. And if you're I'm somebody who wouldn't live in New York for a day because I don't want to live there, and what I write about is here. And you know, it's absolutely indispensable to me to have somebody in New York.
Do you have to have an
looking
agent?
Looking out for me.
You have to have an agent that you trust as much as your editor? You feel as confident in?
In fact, I've gone through this. First, I had a great big agency, and I had an agent at that agency who didn't have a desk in his office, you know, which I found very upsetting. He had this sort of curved, modular, neat furniture, and he also did a lot of record jackets and things. And so I changed, you know, just to try to find somebody that I would feel a personal contact with, just like I do with my editor. And the next one I got was so small that, in fact, she really didn't send out things enough, you know. So it's taken a while to find somebody who is, in fact, a real professional, but really reads, is a reader and cares, you know, and has not only desks in her office, but lots of books. And but for those of us who do not happen to live in New York and do not happen to have contacts there, you've got to have an agent. You really do.
Edmund, how do you feel about agents? Are you besieged by junk mail petitioning you to read this, that, and the other thing?
No, I have had to refuse to read manuscripts for so many years. I'm not pestered by that very much. But the matter of agents is interesting. There is a kind of parallel to what has happened in publishing and editing in that sense. There are less, relatively speaking, agents who perform the classical and reliable editorial function that people such as Mavis McIntosh, for example, McIntosh and Otis used to do, and Elizabeth McKee and others. But there still are a few functioning that way. There are agents with some of the high-powered organizations whose first question when a manuscript is mentioned to them will be, is it commercial? Now, it does not mean that if you say, no, it isn't commercial, they will say, forget it, but it goes immediately into a different kind of slot of urgency or things of that sort. I feel that there was a question here on the outline as to how much the writer should know about the technical and business aspects of publishing. They are so technical nowadays, I think that One of the functions of the agent, the good agent, is to spare the writer having to know those things. The agent has become the all-around business manager for the really productive and successful writer, literary or commercial. And it's a valuable and important function. And of course, the agent has long been the clearinghouse. We know that publishers occasionally find the pearl among the over-the-transom books, but we also know how rare that is. And the publisher who has a long-standing relationship with agents knows that anything that comes in from the agent has been screened and sifted, right, and that it can therefore expedite. Exactly. So it's a very important function. It is a changing function, just as publishing has changing functions, but a very important one, I think.
I think, too, that you do have a number of really irresponsible, well, like I was saying, and I think a lot of publishing has become irresponsible recently, and so have a lot of agents. And I think particularly of something like Scott Meredith, you know, these big ads and the writer, you know, telling these would-be people, would-be writers, that they can make thousands of dollars, and all these people saying, I've made millions of dollars, and send your manuscript to Scott Meredith. And the catch is, of course, that you have to pay them $500 to read it. Mm. And, you know, they pay college sophomores, you know, summer jobs to read your manuscript and write you a little thing.
Now that's a scandal.
It's true.
But you know, it is you've touched upon an irony. It is now as difficult for the new writer to get a hearing from a really reputable and discriminating agent as it is traditionally to get a hearing from a publishing house's editor. That's an irony.
It's harder. They have to really start out and get some stories published, I think, with smaller magazines and so on before an agent will take them on. It's harder to get an agent, I think, than to get a short story or several short stories published today.
I've had to call friends who are agents to, you know, get them to read someone's manuscript.
Right.
All this talk about the role of agents, the role of publishers, I'd like to cast back to our opening thoughts on what constitutes a profession. And it seems to me that from the beginning of the modern period, there's been an ambivalence in the profession of authorship. In the early 18th century, when publishers became larger in London and provided an avenue for writers to make a living. I guess Alexander Pope was the first major writer who actually supported himself with his writing, and he's very proud of it, on the one hand. On the other, he was utterly contemptuous of people who wrote only for money. Or let's say that he professed to be contemptuous of people who wrote for money, and it generated a considerable literary controversy. I think Samuel Johnson, somewhat later in the century, and Matt and Edmund, who are devoted Johnsonians, will correct me on the what he actually said. But he was a bit tired of these sorts of professions and said that no one but a blockhead writes except for money. Partly in reaction to the posture that Pope had taken of writing for posterity, when Pope was in fact a very successful professional writer. Now, so
it also reflected to some degree, however conscious, Johnson's pain at the long Grub Street kind of ordeal had in his early years. There was a certain tinge of that, but still, I think you're quite right that it was a reaction to the mystique of.
The question that I'm posing is: does this ambivalence about the profession? I mean, you view the profession of authorship on the one hand as something that you can do successfully to make a living, for money. On the other hand, you're doing it for higher reasons. If you're really a professional, you're not doing it just for money. Is that still a tension, and how live an issue is it among writers today?
Well, I think this is, my last novel almost didn't get published. Because it was judged as being non-commercial by Harper and Row, who had published my three previous novels, and it is pretty non-commercial, I guess, in a sense.
Well, what does that mean, Lee? Non-commercial?
That means,
just the appeal.
That
of it?
Means that it has a very rural setting, a very specialized setting up in the mountains. That they know that they sell most books in cities, urban centers. They don't think many people are going to want to read about it. That's all these things that I heard.
I think Edmund disagrees with
you. She is so right about that.
Yeah.
I'm clapping my hands to my head.
Yeah, you know, there are all these reasons why nobody's
going
to want to read this particular book.
Exactly.
It's too specialized. It's too rural. It's country. you know, after, even if you've written three novels and then you have a novel that's been turned down consistently for 3 years, you begin to not consider yourself so much as a writer. Because a writer, after a certain point, I think it's indulgent to think of oneself, to be able to call oneself as a writer if one only writes and never sells. You know, I mean, a writer has readers, face right. it. You know, and you begin, having considered myself as a writer for X number of years, I began to think of myself as, well, a teacher who writes and has an unpublishable novel. And so it's a question all the time now, even if you've written, you know, I don't know that my next book will be accepted. I've had 5 books published.
Well,
I don't know
that. How much of a difference
that.
Does that make to you, Lee, when you sit down at the typewriter or with pad and pencil? Do you think, hey, I've got to do something?
Well, actually none, because I've got a good teaching job right now.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to Part 3 in the Center's series of discussions on authorship in America, with particular emphasis on the transitions in professional American writing, publishing, editing, and reviewing over the past 80 years. The speakers are Edmund Fuller, Lee Smith, James West, and Matthew Hodgson. Edmund Fuller is chief book critic for the Wall Street Journal. He's the author of many works of fiction, nonfiction, and textbooks. Lee Smith teaches creative writing at North Carolina State University. Her most recent books include a novel, Black Mountain Breakdown, and a collection of short stories, Cakewalk. James West is a scholar at the National Humanities Center, where he's writing a book on authorship in America. He's a professor of English at Virginia Polytechnic Institute. And Matthew Hodgson is director of the University of North Carolina Press. Here is Edmund Fuller.
Part of the phenomenon here involving the commercial hype combo publishing that we've been talking about along, part of the problem here is that that aspect of publishing, I feel very strongly, is dominated almost as much as television is dominated by what I would call the New York Los Angeles axis. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the people
it's
in New
mindset.
York the people in New York and Los Angeles live in a fantasy world of their own. And their knowledge of what goes on outside of that axis, outside of their inner circle, the knowledge of what people want to see or what people want to read is sometimes fantastically distorted. And it is a very large factor in Lee's experience about people say, well, who would want to read about that? Because the LA New York axis doesn't think perhaps somebody would want to read about that unless they want to read about it or see about it in terms of such schlock as the Dukes of Hazzard or something of that sort.
I was just going to say, we could be talking about primetime television.
Right. Well, the phenomenon spreads over into the commercial and hyped up aspects of publishing to a very marked degree, and I think that's a factor that cannot be overlooked in this mass.
No question about it.
Let me make one remark. I have, you know, it's something you just continue to deal with. When I was very young, my first novel was accepted, and it was from a point of view of a 9-year-old child who was growing up when I grew up, you know, in the late 40s and early 50s. And it was accepted by Harper and Row when I was, I guess, 21. But they said, you know, no reader is going to believe that this 9-year-old child is as idealistic and innocent and so on as you have portrayed her here. So we can't publish this book as it is. We will publish the book if you will take it back and set it in the very early 30s so that our readers will be able to identify with it. And I said, well, how are we going to do that? And they said, oh, we'll have our anachronisms man come down.
Oh, my word.
You know, I mean, this is something you have to deal with all the time if you're not someone who lives in New York.
Was your manuscript, in fact, altered?
Oh, yeah. You know, and things like Stars and Stripes Band-Aids had to be changed, and, you know, TV programs had to be changed back to radio programs, and all the products and brand names and all these kind of things
now,
had to be changed.
Now, you were listening to Amos and Andy rather than watching Superman or something.
That's like right. That. Exactly. And so there is very much this mindset that you have to deal with all the time.
Well, you have, I think, you know, we have a better than average novelist residing in the state, John Ely.
Right.
And I read all of John's books, and I think they're very good. Not one, I think, has sold in any appreciable number.
I just reviewed with great praise The Winter People, which I think is a book of power and
beauty. But they're written, you know, about rural North Carolina, yeah. Usually, something of a sort. It's not going to attract the city crowd.
Matt, what kinds of publishers are there?
Well, you have, you know, the colossi, the very large firms owned by conglomerates, and many of them own several publishing firms. And then you have emerging periodically smaller firms. You have a few traditional firms left. I think Forrest, Strauss and Giroux, Norton. It's difficult to think of a third.
Scribner with Athenaeum joining forces to try to stay independent.
I would think so. And they operate much as publishing companies did during my younger days, making some concessions to, you know, change conditions. They have to. The other kinds of publishers are the smaller ones coming along, where two or three people with some venture capital of their own, or they can find it, decide to publish. And they, in a sense, go after younger writers, avant-garde writers, so usually. Occasionally they hit the jackpot. They come up with someone who's very good. Now, here's the problem, is that this small company with perhaps $1 million or $2 million capital, which isn't very much to keep a publishing operation going very long, and they will publish 10, 15, 20 authors, of which one or two will come to the public notice, and perhaps one will begin selling very well, unexpectedly well. What happens then is that author's agent or some agent comes along and said, I have a package deal from Doubleday, which is tied in with Dell Books and the paperback rights and the movie rights and this, that, and the other, and we will pay you hundreds of thousands of dollars for your next book. And that author leaves that small publishing company. And they're, you know, faced with either getting more capital. In other words, the good authors they develop are bought up, quite literally, by the large houses. Now, even the small companies that begin to make, let's say, some kind of impact in publishing, generate sales of $4 or $5 million. A number of pretty good novelists, good nonfiction, good how to do it books, they're bought up by the larger companies. It's reasonable. A person or two or three people who have a small company, who invested all of their savings in it, who work 12 hours a day to make a go of it, with an adequate staff, and then all of a sudden someone comes to them and says, here is $10 million and we want to buy your company. You can split it between you. And, you know, the idea of the income from my $5 million, I can go down to or live in Santa Barbara or wherever and no more worries. Frequently the deal is sweetened by you will remain in active charge of your company's operations. That usually doesn't happen very long. These people generally are forced out. But that's the problem, as I see it, that the smaller companies get in and they start, if they do achieve success, all too often, the larger companies will buy up their office.
And then we're right
success
back to what...
Success is fatal, in short. Yes. To the...
It's a question of capital. Mm-hmm.
Things have changed. Alfred Knopf, I believe I have this correct, capitalized his initial publishing venture for about $3,000. And when he started, back in those days, one simply didn't need the kinds of money that one needs today.
No.
It's really increased geometrically. It's not just inflation that's done it. The whole structure of the trade has changed.
Let me ask Edmund Fuller, what's the role of the professional reviewer in all of this? Do people who do what you do have a fairly harmonious relationship with writers and publishers and editors? Are you on the outside looking in and talking to the public at large? What?
That's very difficult to pin down. We win the gratitude and the anger of writers according to how we've come down on the question of their books. And it varies greatly. And publishers are very solicitous of reviewers who review for major media of one sort or another. And I enjoy, on the surface of it, from the correspondence that I get, fairly amiable relations with a great many of the mainline publishing houses. And if one has, over the years, reviewed a lot of their books, it doesn't matter much to them whether you have damned this one or praised that one. If you have, they feel that their books have been given an inning with you. But the problem of the reviewer, as distinguished from the problem of the critic, is primarily to make new books known to people who have not yet read them. And whereas the problem of the more formal critic in the longer range, and some of us have played both sides of that field, is to give depth of analytical study to books for people who have indeed read those books and who know about them. And the fundamental obligation, as I see it, of the journalistic book reviewer, an obligation which is not always honored, is to read the book thoroughly, to be sure that you are reviewing the book that the author wrote and not something else, and to try your best to give the reader of your journal, who might be interested in this book, a chance to know whether it does indeed sound to him like or her something like something that they would like to read. And objectivity, as far as possible, is a very important thing.
We talked a while ago about responsibility, Edmund. Would you say that your connection is chiefly to the public, to the writers, or to the publishing business?
My responsibility is to my readers first. And obviously one has a responsibility to the journal for which one is writing, but the journal's view is that the responsibility is first to the readers. So that's where it comes in. The responsibility that reviewers have to the writer, and I think there is one, and the responsibility that they have to the publisher is as much honesty and fairness of mind and objectivity as one can muster as a faulty and fallible human being. But that's what I meant when in an earlier phase of something else, they were saying that integrity, one's sense of personal integrity, is the thing that has to rule. And that's a very intangible thing, difficult to pin down.
You've been listening to Soundings, conversations originating at the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond. The center is interested in your comments. Write to us at the National Humanities Center, Post Office Box 12256, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina 27709. Soundings is made possible, in part, by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and is distributed by the Public Affairs Broadcast Group, Los Angeles, California. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center with an invitation for you to join me for the third part in a series of discussions about authorship in the United States. What are the lineaments of American publishing over the last 75 years? How do current American commercial and cultural characteristics affect American authorship? The chief book critic for the Wall Street Journal, the head of the University of North Carolina Press, a novelist, and a scholar at the National Humanities Center provide the answers. Authorship in America, Part 3. Listen this week for Soundings.